Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad has been a frequent critic of U.S. foreign policy, but he was one of the first Muslim leaders to offer unqualified support for the U.S. war on terrorism. The mainly Muslim nation of 20 million people has yet to be a terrorist target, but Malaysian authorities are worried it might. In part three of Morning Edition series on terrorism in Southeast Asia, NPR's Michael Sullivan reports Malaysians have good reason to worry, especially since terrorist groups have used the country as a haven.
The most wanted man in Southeast Asia today lived for nearly a decade in a tiny one-room house in a village about an hour's drive from the capital, Kuala Lumpur, along a busy road flanked by palm plantations and factories of computer giants like NEC and Toshiba. House 86D is set back a few hundred yards from the road, a small wooden structure next to a field being cleared by a local farmer. It was here that the accused Indonesian terrorist known as Hambali came after he returned to the region from Afghanistan. Hambali is believed to be the operations chief of the Southeast Asian terror group Jamaah Islamiyah and is also thought to be a member of Al-Qaeda's inner circle. His next-door neighbor for a time was Jamaah Islamiyah's spiritual leader, Abu Bakr Bashir, who came here after serving time in a Suharto-era jail for preaching extremism. Hambali's former landlord, 54-year-old government worker Mior Muhammad Yuhana, says the accused terror mastermind Hambali was a good tenant.
Hambali is a soft-spoken guy, and he's good to everybody. When he was here, he's a kebab seller, selling Arab medicine. Apart from that, he usually left this area for a month, 2 months.
Neighbor Haji Abdullah says the cleric Abu Bakr Bashir also seemed pleasant enough when he was around. Bashir lived here, but he wasn't here a lot either, the farmer says. Most of the time he would just show up on weekends when they would have their cell group meeting and study Islam together. But it wasn't radical or anything, the farmer says. It was all very peaceful. In all, nearly a dozen Jamaah Islamiyah members lived here at one time or another. Zachary Abuza, author of an upcoming book on Southeast Asian terror groups.
They did not preach in mosques. They went from house to house and they recruited slowly. They were allowed to live there because in the Malaysian eyes, they posed no threat to Malaysia. No one really understood their links to a wider international network of Al-Qaeda.
And at the time, says Sidney Jones, Indonesia project director for the International Crisis Group, Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad was promoting himself as the champion of anti-Western, anti-globalization forces.
You could meet in Malaysia in the early 1990s virtually any Muslim guerrilla group that you would hope to imagine, whether it was the Moro National Liberation Front, the various Palestinian groups. These people were sitting there talking to each other, getting to know each other, and making contact with radical groups in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Making contact was made easier by Malaysia's aggressive efforts to market itself as Southeast Asia's premier travel and business destination. Relentless ad campaigns depicting Malaysia as an ethnically diverse paradise were used to entice visitors. So were lax immigration laws and visa-free entry for nationals of most Islamic and Western countries. All this made Malaysia an ideal place for extremist groups to meet and to plan operations. The authorities either didn't know about or chose to ignore their presence. Until a year and a half ago, there was little evidence to suggest that the radical Islamic ideology espoused by these groups could take root in Malaysia. Little evidence, that is, until the summer of 2001. In May 2001, three men tried to rob this branch of the Southern Bank in a suburb of the capital, Kuala Lumpur. Two of the men were killed, the third was wounded, captured, and began to talk.
That was the wake-up call. That was what alerted the intelligence agencies to the fact that something more than just a pure criminal thing was going on.
Dr. Muhammad Johar Hassan is Director General of Malaysia's Institute for Strategic and International Studies. The something more that police discovered, he says, was that the three men were members of a homegrown radical group called the Kumpulan Mujahideen Malaysia, which is seeking the violent overthrow of Malaysia's secular government. The money from the bank job, the wounded man said, was for Muslim militias fighting Christians in neighboring Indonesia. Police soon discovered that the KMM had links to other radical groups such as Jamaah Islamiyah, and more disturbing information followed, information that confirmed Al-Qaeda's presence in Malaysia. Southeast Asian terror expert Zakaria Buza says that information included details of a key meeting of Al-Qaeda operatives in Kuala Lumpur in the run-up to the attack on the USS Cole.
Key planners of the USS Cole attack and September 11th, including two or three of the hijackers, were there. So this was a very important meeting.
The meeting was held in an apartment owned by an associate of the alleged terror chief Hambali, a former Malaysian army officer named Yazid Sufat. On Hambali's orders, Sufat is believed to have acquired 4 tons of ammonium nitrate for attacks on Western targets in neighboring Singapore. Authorities say Sufat also helped obtain a U.S. visa for Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, in the September 11th attacks. Sufat and more than 60 other alleged terrorists are now in jail. Malaysia's largest religious party, PAS, says the arrests are an excuse for the government to use the terror threat to eliminate its political enemies. PAS seeks an Islamic government in Malaysia, but through peaceful means. Several PAS members are among those detained. But the government denies any political motive, and most Western governments, including the U.S., give Malaysia high marks for its crackdown on extremists.
Malaysia has been an excellent partner in the war on terrorism.
Frank Whitaker is press officer at the U.S. Embassy in Kuala Lumpur.
We're confident that the Malaysians continue to watch it and monitor it very carefully.
At the same time, however, the October bombings on the Indonesian resort island of Bali have shaken the Malaysians badly, because they know if it can happen there, it can happen here too. Again, Muhammad Johar Hassan of the Institute for Strategic and International Studies.
All it takes is for a small group, highly motivated, with some explosives, they could go and blow up one major landmark in Malaysia, particularly a landmark which is a tourist attraction, and that's it. And Malaysia will be finished.
Tourism would be the first casualty. Foreign investment would be the next. The Malaysians know this, but visa requirements are still extremely loose. As Malaysia continues its efforts to woo Gulf oil money and make the country a center for Islamic banking. Nonetheless, says Andrew Tan of Singapore's Institute of Defense and Strategic Studies, Malaysia's days as a safe haven for Muslim extremists appear to be over.
I think Mahathir is also well aware of the long-term dangers that radicalism will pose towards a multiracial country like Malaysia. I don't think the atmosphere nowadays is going to be quite that conducive. We're all wiser after the fact. Governments are now very vigilant.
Wiser and more vigilant, but not out of the woods. Not with 4 tons of ammonium nitrate still missing, and Hambali still at large. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Kuala Lumpur.
Tomorrow, Singapore, where authorities intervened to stop a major Jamaah Islamiyah attack. The first two reports in the series are at npr.org.